Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's the political season, of course. We're heading up to an election, and politics is getting supercharged and superheated, and a lot of the issues that are coming out around this. Senator James Inhofe yesterday with Barbara Boxer going at it, the United States Senate. Ellen Ranner giving us the lowdown yesterday afternoon. The audio you can hear over at talkradionews.com of this, shall we call it, friendly debate. And at the same time, Ted Turner came out yesterday, and this in an interview with the Atlanta Constitution Journal. Ted Turner says, if steps aren't taken to stem global warming, we'll be 8 degrees hotter in 30 or 40 years, and basically none of the crops will grow. Most of the people will have died. The rest will be cannibals. Civilization will have broken down. The few people left will be living in a failed state like Somalia or Sudan, and living conditions will be intolerable. Possible? Mark Morano is with us. He's the communications director for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, and on the staff of Senator James Inhofe, the website epw.senate.gov. Mark Morano, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I hope you don't agree with Ted Turner on that. I mean, that's
well, actually,
cannibalism.
You know, yeah. Well, let me you know, just toss this at you. The way that Inhofe and you and many of your compatriots have the major media device, shall we say, and I don't mean that in a, you know, as a slam, that you have been using to convince people that people like me are alarmists on this issue, is this documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle, that is all over the internet, that was produced and played on BBC, 2 years ago, I think it was?
I think it was last year, actually.
Yeah, last year, okay. And this is based on the work of Danish scientist Henrik Svensmark of the Danish National Space Center. And he suggests that basically the planet is warming because solar radiation has been going up. Well, yesterday the BBC ran an article, Richard Black, the environmental correspondent, the headline, No Sun Link to Climate Change. This was published in the Physics Journal, Environmental Research Letters. And they tried to find they looked at every different way they could. They came up with three different ways to search for a correlation between solar winds and changes in solar energy and global warming. And they found none. And the scientists now say this proves that this theory that is being peddled with your video, The Great Global Warming Swindle, is false, and that, in fact, it is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases increasing that's leading to the global warming that we're seeing.
Actually, I just heard about the study this morning, and actually I've seen correspondence from Svensmark, who's already said the study is misinterpreting his original data. First of all, if you look up our Senator Inhofe's speeches or anything, I don't think we've ever, I can't say never, but we've never really talked about the cosmic ray theory, only because it's a cutting-edge theory and still out there.
Well, you and I have certainly discussed it.
What's that?
I said you and I have certainly discussed it.
Yes, it's one of the factors, but here's the thing. This study, there's been another one last summer, the BBC hyped as well, and that had to do, you know, no solar climate connection or no recent solar climate connection. The problem is if you read this BBC article today, you will find it says, well, the last 20 years we should have been cooling or things should have been changing. Well, guess what? And this is according to MIT's Richard.
If you're looking at solar radiation.
No, I'm talking about just global temperatures. Well, there's really been no significant warming since 95, according to Richard Lindz in an analysis he just put out recently. The high point, again, was 98 with El Nino. So maybe there is something. This study claims
then why?
This study implies global temperatures are runaway and rampant, when in reality they're not. So maybe the study's wrong. Also, it doesn't take into account cloud cover, oceans, the lack of volcanic dust, which another peer-reviewed study came out and said that's contributed to warming, solar system controlling. There's so many other factors.
Well, actually,
not cosmic ray versus CO2. That's the whole point here.
Well, it's not cosmic rays.
Well, it's not cosmic ray versus CO2. And again, you're talking about a trace gas in the atmosphere, CO2, that they're trying to say is explaining, you know, all this theory.
It's a major greenhouse gas. I mean, the levels of CO2 in Venus account for it having a surface temperature 800 degrees Fahrenheit.
It absolutely does. But the bottom line is you cannot distinguish current climate from natural variability. We're coming out of a little ice age.
Then why is it that
these computer models,
why is it the 9 out of the 10 hottest years, 15 out of the 20 hottest years are in the last 10 or the last 20 years?
Since when? kind of data. Again, that makes sense for the modern era. We're coming out of the Little Ice Age. But if you look at the 1930s, again, in the U.S., which we had the best temperature data, four of the 10 hottest years were the 1930s. 1934 is still the hottest. This is before.
Well, there's significant speculation that the reason for that it was heating up in the 30s was the beginning of the pumping of enormous amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that the reason it started cooling in the 50s, and the 40s and the 50s, was because not only were we throwing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we were throwing enormous amounts of particulate pollutants up there because it was dirty coal and oil plants and things like that, and dirty cars, and that particulate pollution in the atmosphere was reflecting sunlight out. It was increasing the albedo effect. And then in the 1970s, the United States was leading, but Europe was also very active in this. In the 1970s, the industrialized world got very serious about cleaning up the air. We cleaned up the air, and so now more sunlight could get in. And then in the 1990s, China started industrializing, and now China and India are doing what we were doing in the 50s, throwing enormous amounts of particulate matter into the atmosphere and thus increasing the amount of reflected solar radiation. So we're seeing these variations that are both cooling and warming, although they all follow a warming arc that seem to have to do with industrial activity.
Now, first of all, 80% of CO2 came after 1940. So you had the Arctic high point in the 30s before 80% of CO2. You had Greenland's high point in 1940 or 41. You have the Antarctic, which has cooled over the last 50 years. The vast majority of it has actually gained ice and has record ice extent.
That's not because it's cooling. That's because it's warming.
Air carries more
moisture when it's warmer.
Now, Antarctica has actually been cooling over the vast majority. The Western Peninsula that Al Gore and many others like, that has been warming, and that's way more.
But if you take the entire continent, it is warming.
The vast majority is cooling, according to
the entire continent is warming. I mean, let's look at the whole thing.
That's a dispute we'd have to go back and look at, but absolutely not.
Well, you want to take a little select piece, and you're right. Al Gore does point to one select piece. I'm saying look at the entire continent as the IPCC did. It's warming. And it's warming, and that allows there to be more snow.
We have a factual disagreement on that, then. The vast majority is cooled, according to the data I looked at. I don't have it in front of me, but I will say, I would be glad to document that after the program here. I don't want to spend too much time on that exact point, but the bottom line is it's cooling, and ice extent has grown to record since satellite monitoring began. And the media hyped this little tiny piece that broke off. And one of the analyses I saw said
tiny piece, five times the size of Manhattan?
Right. And if that piece, say something like that broke off every year, it would take 33,000 years for the ice to disappear. That's how tiny. One of the meteorologists who studied it said it's like an icicle falling off a snow and ice covered roof.
Well, here's a better metaphor for you. It's the physical volume of a cork is relatively insignificant compared to the volume of wine in a wine bottle. But if you pull that cork out and that wine bottle is upside down, you're going to have a whole lot of wine on the floor.
Right.
There is concern that this ice that is breaking off is the cork that is blocking these glaciers from flowing out into the sea. And now that this ice at the mouth of these glaciers is breaking off and falling away, that we're going to see as we're seeing in Greenland right now, and you have to acknowledge this. I mean, now you've got the oil companies talking about wanting to drill in Greenland because of the deglaciation.
Back to Antarctica, though, the vast majority cooling, and there's also
not the entire continent.
There's also volcanic activity there, and it's also being blamed on ocean currents. Nothing's as simple as CO2.
But the ocean currents are a consequence of the planet warming.
Not necessarily. That's another whole issue. We have the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which changed all the currents, I think, 1979 or so, and that made the Arctic.
Well, there are periodic variations, obviously, in this thing, but the fact of the matter is, and I think you have to agree with this, that the carbon dioxide concentrations and carbon, other forms of carbon concentrations in the oceans have increased. Some are arguing to saturation levels in the last 40 years.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that CO2 levels are going up, but the question is, at what point does CO2 continue to have a warming effect? What a warming effect!
Well, the question is, at what point does the ocean say enough? I can't take any more CO2, and because it's been one of the things that's been sinking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And then we've got a real disaster.
Right, but again, historically and over long periods of time, the CO2 follows temperature increases. And, it's actually easier to say that temperature increases drive CO2, not the other way around.
No, I would say that what you're seeing is the effect of the oceans sinking out carbon dioxide.
That's the new theory now. As the Earth fails to follow the climate models, they're all turning to ocean acidification, and it's kind of the argument's kind of shifting.
Well, they're turning to it because it makes sense.
Well, it's turning to it because the climate models aren't working out. In fact, right now, all you have, when you first mentioned polar bears, all they have, we have record numbers of polar bear by the U.S. Geological Survey. All you have are computer models 40 years from now to scare people that they're not going to be around, when in reality, the Arctic goes in about 40-year cycles. And
okay,
they,
well... If people want to check out your point of view, Mark Morano with James Inhofe's office, epw.senate.gov. And, Mark, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, go ahead, make my day. 20 minutes past the hour. There's this whole big issue of global warming and whether or not the polar bear should be listed as an endangered species. You heard Mark Morano saying there's more polar bears than there have ever been. Mark isn't here to defend himself. I'm not going to pick on him about that, but I would suggest that that's a disputable topic. And, in fact, Senator John Barrasso, the Republican from Wyoming, taking this on. These are the official Republican talking points here.
My primary concern is this. If the polar bear is listed under the rationale that global warming could cause a decline, then thousands of other species will follow.
Yep.
How can we possibly preclude any species on the planet from being listed under this rationale? The consequences to our society would be dramatic and devastating. Virtually every human activity that involves the release of carbon into the atmosphere would have to be regulated by the federal government. Driving to work, harvesting corn for ethanol production, building a new road. Whole cities could be sued for not restricting the number of cars that can be on the road within the city limits.
Well, actually, I would say this is a wild exaggeration of what's going to come about as a result of listing the polar bear as an endangered species. But his larger issue... There is a point here, and that is that if global warming is real, it's going to require a systemic response to it. I mean, we have to look at every dimension of what we're doing and basically say it's time to get the carbon out. Now, if the reality is that global warming is happening, and here you have 99% of the world's finest scientists saying, yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. The IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, the United Nations, the official United Nations body, and all these scientists saying, yep, global warming is real. We need to do something about it. You've got scientists looking at the polar bears saying, polar bears are drowning. They're starving. They're running out of ice. The polar ice caps are melting. There's no disputing that. In fact, right now, countries are starting to argue over who's going to have the shipping lanes when the North Pole is gone. If all that's the case, then we get back to the statement that I opened this show with by Ted Turner that, if steps aren't taken to stem global warming, we'll be 8 degrees hotter in 30 or 40 years. Basically, none of the crops will grow. He says most of the people will have died. The rest of us will be cannibals. Civilization will have broken down. The few people will be living like a failed state, like Somalia or Sudan, and living conditions will be intolerable. Well, I was in Sudan 2 weeks ago on the border with Darfur, and I can tell you, it's hell. It's absolute hell. And what we're seeing in northern Sudan is that the desert is moving south. The equatorial regions, the regions around the equator, all around the planet, are seeing increasing desertification, the growth of deserts. You're seeing the loss of glaciers in the Andes, in the Himalayas. The glaciers are shrinking. Here in Portland, Oregon, Mount Hood, just up the road from us, you can see it from our house. Here's this mountain. 30% of the glaciers on this mountain have vanished in the last 30 or 40 years. 30%. And these are the glaciers that historically locked up the snow, the winter rains as snow, because you get above a couple thousand feet here, and it all comes down to snow. This is a great skiing area. But that have historically locked up that snow year-round and slowly released it. And because they're not locking it up anymore, the flood risk for us living here in Portland, and this is a particular concern to me because I live on a houseboat in one of the rivers here in Portland, and in fact we had a sea lion in our backyard yesterday. This is incredible. Louise and I are walking home. We're walking down the dock because our house is like out in the river, and it's chained to a dock, you know, and look out of the back of the house, and right behind our house this thing just pops up out of the water, and it's like an 800-pound sea lion. And his partner, I'm assuming, was just maybe 200-300 yards down the way with a fish, and there was 10 or 20 seagulls that were trying to get the fish away from it, and it was snapping this giant salmon around and busting it into pieces and chowing it down. But this one that popped up in our backyard, we ran out in the back, you know, with a camera to take a picture of it, and it was already gone. I think he heard us walking on the deck and just took off. But in any case, those of us who live on or near rivers or cities that are on seacoasts, Seattle, New York, I mean, you know, right across the board, we all have reason to be very concerned about this fact. And in India, they're very concerned about the glaciers going away because it's going to mean less water filling the rivers like the Ganges, which is almost entirely water, or at least the first third of it is almost entirely water from the Himalayan glaciers. That if these glaciers dry up, and they are, if they evaporate, if they melt out and evaporate, the water evaporates, there's going to be no more river water, no more river water, no more food. We're talking about mass famine. It's already starting to happen. I saw it with my own eyes in Africa just 2 weeks ago. You can see the pictures, by the way, on our blog over at, you go to tomhartman.com and click Tom's blog, and you just scroll down a little bit. You can see all the pictures from when we were on the border with Darfur in southern Sudan. Not all of them, but the ones that we put up so far. And there's a whole bunch of them over at Talk Radio News as well, along with some video and some audio, talkradionews.com, from that trip. But I'm telling you, I've seen it. It's real, it's going on, and it's affecting people right now. Now, Ted Turner might have been a little hyperbolic. In fact, he might have been a lot hyperbolic because there are, you know, temperate regions where the change is not going to be that great because it's just going to kind of sweep over. But in the equatorial regions and in the polar regions, the change is dramatic, and we're already seeing it. And what kind of effort is it going to take to solve this problem? It's going to take a political effort. It's going to take political will. And the Republicans are all running away from this. The Democrats are saying, let's do something about it. God bless them. 27
seconds. You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour, and welcome back. Let's see, if ice is increasing in Antarctica in only one area, the eastern mainland, and this is because as the air becomes warmer in Antarctica, snowfalls increase. And I mean, this Greenland is losing three times more ice than Antarctica, compensating for the decrease in sea levels as a consequence of the increasing glacier cap in Antarctica. So, I mean, the debate is going to go on as long as, you know, without impugning anybody's specific motives, as long as there's money to be made on global warming. But the reality is that we are on a carbon-based economy right now, and it ain't a good thing. And when you consider the amount of solar radiation that's falling, for example, in the American Southwest, it's absolutely mind-boggling. There is more energy in the sun hitting the desert, in the American Southwest. They go out in the Mojave Desert. If we could simply convert that to electricity, use that electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, release the oxygen into the atmosphere, bottle the hydrogen, package the hydrogen, ship it around the country to fuel cars, like the guy we were talking with from General Motors yesterday, let's have hydrogen cars, we would not need to import oil. I mean, yeah, we're looking a little down the road, but, you know, we wouldn't need to import oil. So, I mean, there's so much we can do with this. We'll take your calls in just a second, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. But first, our full Monty alert.
Take off your coat.
Uh-oh. Octopuses. No, seriously. Slow.
Baby, take off your shoes.
Our full Monty alert here. Marine biologists studying wild octopuses have found a kinky and violent society of jealous murderers, gender subterfuge, and once-in-a-lifetime sex. They witness picky macho males carefully select a mate, then guard their newly domesticated digs so jealously that they would occasionally use their 20 to 25-centimeter tentacles to strangle a romantic rival to death. And size does matter, but not how you'd think. UC Berkeley biologist Roy Caldwell, who co-authored this study on octopuses out of the University of California, says if you're going to spend time guarding a female, you want to go for the biggest female you can find because she's going to produce more eggs. It's basically an investment strategy. Although shortly after the female gives birth, about a month after conception, both the mother and the father die. Ouch! So, anyhow, our octopus alert for the day. Very strange. Oh, and I just have to add, when the sea lion broke the surface last night before behind our house, our cat, we've got this rescue cat, Higgins, that our son rescued from a dorm back, I don't know, 5 years ago or so. And Higgins was raised with a pit bull and is crazy. And any new person walks into the house, I mean, Louise actually once caught him in midair as he was flying across off the kitchen counter toward a plumber who was fixing something, caught him in midair as he was heading for this guy's face. We had some friends brought a dog over once, and Higgins flew across the air and landed on the dog's head. And that dog still has PTSD from that experience. And so, anyhow, Higgins is looking out the back. We've got a sliding glass door that looks out on the back deck, and that's all floating in the river, you know. And he's looking at the sea lion coming out of the water going, I want that! So, you know, the people in the chat room were like, you know, what did Higgins think about that? That's what he thought about it. Matt in Beaverton, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
All right. I'm doing great. Thanks. First of all, I'd like to say I'm a big fan. I've listened to your show for a long time and really appreciate all you're doing. And I wanted to call regarding the gentleman that was speaking about climate change. And according to his numbers, which I'm not sure are correct, but he said that, you know, the large chunk that broke off recently, that that Antarctica would melt in 33,000 years. Now, in geological time, That's
pretty
really
fast,
nothing.
Actually.
Yeah, I mean, Antarctica has been there for millions of years. So, anyway, but I was on a commercial break, and I flipped over to Fox News just to see what they were ranting about. And I actually caught Lars Larson talking about climate change and how it wasn't a bad thing. So I actually talked to him for about 20 minutes on air.
Yeah, Matt, I'm going to leave it at that because I just, you know, I don't want to be discussing other talk show hosts on our show, but it's bad radio, I think. But the reality is that, yeah, there are a bunch of people out there denying that climate change is happening. And then the ones who don't deny it, the ones who acknowledge the science, say, yeah, well, it's happening. It's going to be a good thing, you know, because in the Arctic, we'll be able to drill for oil. Give me a break. Steve in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Oh, I think you're also doing a great job. I'm just saying,
thank you,
sick of the deniers. And I found out a couple of weeks ago that Mr. Andrew Rice is running against Inhofe. So you can get all the information.
Andrew Rice is running as a Democrat against Inhofe,
yes,
the Republican.
And he considers the Iraq War and global warming to be problems.
Oh, interesting. He's got a good Democratic opponent in this. Inhofe is up for re-election in 2008?
I don't even know. I just found out he's running against him. I went to andrewforoklahoma.com, and I donated $50 to his campaign.
There you go. Okay.
That's all I'm doing. Anybody against Inhofe, that's what I'm going to do.
Okay. Steve, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. Frank in Miami, Florida, you don't believe in global warming.
Well, and that's not the issue, Tom. I was going to compliment you on, I think that was the first time I've heard a liberal talk show host actually engage the topic. Usually what I hear is the debate is over, there's a consensus of scientists, and if you don't agree with them, then you are in the pocket of big oil. And so it was refreshing to hear you actually engage in dialogue, discuss some of the issues.
Well, thank you. We try to do that every day here on this program, by the way, to discuss the issues rather than just, you know, have some politician come on and pontificate or whatever.
Well, I think you'll have to admit that that's not always the case with a lot of your compadres. But I want to just mention that I'm a teacher of graduate students. These people have been through college, and we had projects that involved producing media about global warming. I have to bite my tongue not to sound like a skeptic. I don't want to prejudice them. But the thing I find, Tom, is that these kids are so indoctrinated, they have no clue of the issues, they have no clue of the countervailing evidence, they don't understand, they don't know nothing, have read nothing of people who disagree with the issue. John Christie.
You're not going to invoke Fred Singer here, are you?
What?
You're not going to. I mean, Fred Singer has been on this program. There, some of these guys, you know, as you probably figured out, I am clearly of the opinion that the IPCC is right, and yet I will engage the topic. But you know, and Mark Morano actually, you know, to his credit, I mean, he's on Inhofe's staff. He has to deal with the science, and there are, as you point out, there are some scientific anomalies here in this, and there have been changes in the debate over time, and he's quick to point them out, and he does a very good job of it. But some of these guys are just, I suppose, on both sides, just crackpots.
Well, but not only the science, but I'm talking about the manipulation of the data. Wegman, you know, who did the statistical analysis and was hired by the committee to go over man's hockey stick analysis. And these things the students are just totally unaware of. Tom, I was there for their first Earth Day, and we went down, and they were protesting global cooling. And they told us that you could go to the glaciers and put tarps on them to absorb the heat. So that you know, I mean, this is nutty.
Wait a minute, protesting global cooling?
Yes, they were protesting global cooling. Go back, Tom. There's front page stories on Newsweek and Time about global
cooling. Oh, you're talking about 30 years ago. Yeah.
And I'm just saying, anybody who's lived through this stuff, who's lived through the population bomb, who's lived through the Club of Rome limits of growth, all it's the same story. Now, that doesn't...
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because you know, I in fact, I was just revisiting last weekend the 1972 Club of Rome population growth study, and I was also rereading Thomas Malthus, and you know Malthus, you know back in the 18th century was writing that you know everything was going to hell in a handbasket because England was so overpopulated. Was it the 17th century? England was so overpopulated and the world was going to fall apart and because of overpopulation. And you know England dealt with that to some extent by simply exporting people. They dealt with it to some extent with early death. You know, it's working people to death and diseases. But the big thing is, and this is where some of the skeptics, some of the arguers, the people who were pushing back against the population bomb, for example, actually were right, is that as technology changes, the carrying capacity of the planet changes. But I would submit to you that we are well beyond the carrying capacity of this planet at 6 billion people.
Why?
There is not a single ecosystem on this planet that's not in decline right now.
Oh, Tom.
Name one.
Well,
name a species that is not in decline other than the human race.
First of all, I'd say look at the air quality of L.A. 40 years ago and look at the air quality today.
Well, that's a very isolated example. You look at the planet, you're seeing the as a consequence of the industrialization of China and India, you know, we're simply exporting the pollution that we used to do in the 40s and 50s to China.
Tom, I suggest you get on your program. It was co-authored with Julian, who died before the book was published, I believe. But
with who?
You know who Julian Simon is?
Yes, Julian Simon, in fact, was the, you know, I remember Dan, what's his name, wrote Ishmael, used to, I'm sorry? Oh, Daniel Quinn, that's right. Daniel Quinn used to have on his website, he used to say, do you want to save the world or not? And if you said no, you were taking to Julian Simon's website. And Julian Simon was the one who said, nothing to worry about with population, with environment, with anything else, because human creativity will solve all problems. And Julian Simon's no longer with us, but he had a bet with Paul Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, that commodity prices would actually go down over 20 years, and he won the bet. I mean,
he won on every commodity.
Yeah, exactly. Julian Simon was right over the short term, but is he right over the long term? And this is the Wall Street Journal had this article, front page article. You know, was Malthus right last? I think it was last Thursday or Friday. And I think the argument is still engaged. Frank, we're out of time, but I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
I was tired of my party. We were down on our luck. With lifetime politicians only out for a buck. And then at home one evening, reading Craigslist online, and in the personal section, you know this pose caught my eye. If you like Barack Obama versus more of the same, if you're not into Clinton, if you're not for McCain, and if you want a new direction, and you're tired of the games, vote with me for Obama, and be an agent of change. I've examined the options on the political scene, and the other contenders seem like the same old routine. So I responded to the posting with an ad of my own. And though I'm not much of a writer, I thought it struck the right tone. If you like Barack Obama,
well, okay, nice bumper music. I think that Hillary Clinton, as well as Barack Obama, both represent significant change. And that's where I'm parking my flag for the moment. Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Anna, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I was just going to bring up that topic of population growth. I think that there are almost 7 billion people.
Yes, we're pushing 7.
On a single planet.
Yeah,
with obviously finite resources. And they're being used by these 7 billion people right now.
Yes, we are consuming now more than 50% of the planet's net productive capacity, the amount of solar energy that is converted into things that can be used for food. Anna, excellent point. And when you look at the arc of the growth of population, it's astounding. It took the oldest human fossils are 165,000 years old. So 165,000 years or 163,000 years up until the time of Christ, we were at a quarter of a billion people. We hit a half a billion people in the year 1000. At the time of the Crusades, there were a half a billion people. In 1800, finally the year 1800, we hit our first 1 billion people. That was also the century when we started using what I call ancient sunlight. And my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, is all about this. That was when we started using oil. And we were using coal aggressively in the 5 centuries before that. And so we hit 1 billion humans in that year, 1800. So all of human history, 165,000 years, arguably millions of years of history leading up to humanity, all of human history to produce the first 1 billion people in the year 1800. The second billion people only took 130 years, 1930. The third billion people only took 30 years, 1960. I remember when John Kennedy was inaugurated. I was a little kid, but I remember when it happened. There were only 3 billion people on the planet, fewer than half as many as there are today. The fourth billion only took 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion only took 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion only took 11 years, 1999. And now we're well on our way to the seventh billion. When you see that kind of explosive growth in a population, if you were looking at, for example, bacteria in a bloodstream, you would say, this is an organism that's going to die. This explosion of a particular, one particular species among all the others in an ecosystem is, well, it's the other biological metaphor for it is cancer. It's just an absolute explosion. So, anyhow, Colleen in Glen Allen, California. Hey, Colleen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I would like to present some solutions for you. First one is, the word greenhouse gas came to the public's attention in 1973 in the movie Soylent Green, and I invite everyone to go back and watch that again. I think we could end the argument by reframing the issue. Climate change is natural. Human activities certainly can accelerate it or slow it. So we can move away, is it global warming or global cooling, by just talking about these extreme changes that we're going through.
Sure.
And I'm fortunate to live in Sonoma County, where we were the first county in the nation to have every city and the county government sign on to climate protection goals.
Yeah, and here in Portland, Oregon, the city, and I believe the state, but I know the city has met the Kyoto standards.
I have one other solution in mind for this. Are we adding up the carbon footprint to the undeclared wars that are taking place?
Clearly we're not.
So,
you know, the largest consumer of this largest single consumer of oil in the United States is our military.
So the way for us to end the undeclared wars is to follow the California State Democratic Party's platform. At the last hour, we got insertion to their platform on the World Peace and International Relations section, calling for the repeal of the 2002 authorization for military use of force, also to stop the funding except to get out, and most importantly, a call for an international conference to implement a ceasefire.
Excellent point. Excellent point, Colleen. Thank you very much. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, you were talking about exponential growth of population. You know, exponential growth is a great theory when you're doing your retirement savings, but it's not a
Yeah, in biological systems, it's called amplification. When you see that happen, you know, when you see a virus or a bacteria or something suddenly explode, you know, amplify like that logarithmically rather than linearly, you say, wait a minute, this is we're looking at the death of the host.
Craziness. Well, one of the problems we face is a lack of fresh water, and I guess I have two questions for you. You know, when we watched the movie Gandhi and he did the protest against the British to make salt, he basically boiled the water. You know, what is it about the desalinization of ocean water that makes the process so expensive? And are you familiar with reverse osmosis?
Yeah, I am.
Water passes through membranes that separates the water from the salt. Don't you think that would help us? I mean, we're having water wars. World aquifers are being drained rapidly.
Yeah. I've tasted you know, salt water that has been processed by reverse osmosis, and it still tastes a little brackish. And reverse osmosis is increasingly being used, and it's used routinely in actually, I have a friend up in Michigan who's got a big old farmhouse, and they use it for their water because their water has so much iron in it. So it's not uncommon. It's getting more sophisticated, but it's still very expensive. The reason why basically distilling salt water and to produce water is so expensive relative to the cost of water is it takes just an enormous amount of energy. My recollection is 500 calories per cc of water to evaporate it. But whatever it is, it's an enormous amount of energy. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what are we doing with the economy? The auction rate lockout. This is the headline in today's Wall Street Journal. Values tossed around as individual investors can't get at their cash. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, international best-selling, New York Times best-selling author of a number of books, including two of my favorites, The Myth of Free Trade, The Great American Deception, The Greenspan's Fraud, The New Golden Age. His website, Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com. Ravi, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
And let me just toss it out to our listeners. You are available to be with us for a couple of segments here, right?
Yes.
And so if any of our listeners have questions for an economist, for Dr. Batra, our number 866-303-2270, and after you and I have had a brief conversation here, we'll take 5-10 minutes, and then we'll turn it over to our listeners and let them ask you questions. We've done this in the past, and it's always worked out very well. The last time you were on the show, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, and you were saying that, in your opinion, even putting your money into money market funds wasn't such a safe thing. And here on today's Wall Street Journal front page of the financial section, Tracy Young, a 53-year-old mother of two who helps manage family funds through a USB AG account, got a different assessment. The $3 million in short-term securities she held had been marked down by $170,000. I'm in a panic, she said. Many firms like Merrill Lynch and UBS have placed their customers in short-term investments known as auction rate securities that are supposed to be as safe and liquid as cash. The promise of liquidity dried up weeks ago, leaving investors stuck with securities they can't sell. And some banks are actually marking these things down. They're saying, you thought you had $100,000? Now you've got $70,000. Is this, you know, what does this mean?
Well, well, you and I have been talking about this economic crisis for several months now.
We've been talking about it for a couple of years on this program, you and I.
Right. And really, I hate to say it, but there's not a single thing that I said which has not proved true.
You're right.
I mean, I said oil prices will sharply go up. They are high. Inflation will be rising, cost of living, and food prices will be rising. They're high. Gold, I said, would skyrocket. That's still very high. Stock market would tank. Banking system would be in shambles. All this is happening. And I have a way of forecasting which is very different from the way these other people forecast. They don't look at the fundamentals.
Right.
They look at how credit can be created, how we can simply prolong, postpone the problems by luring people into debt and all these things. But debt creation is not the answer. Even now,
yeah,
they have bailed out to Bear Stearns through by pumping more money into the economy. You know,
right. And essentially debasing our currency.
Exactly. Debasing our currency, and it's going to come back in terms of even higher prices. The interesting part is that they're still living in denial.
Yeah.
I hear from them, you know, they say there are three problems right now. They call it a housing meltdown, then credit crunch, and Wall Street. These are the three problems. Not a single one of them talks about oil price.
Yeah. Yeah.
See,
yeah, which is incredible, because that's what fuels our economy. I mean, it's gasoline prices, everything, you know, our food is essentially made out of oil, because the fertilizers are made out of oil. The engines, the farm tractors and things are driven by oil. The food is transported by oil. It's cooled. It's refrigerated. It's processed with oil. I mean, we're eating oil.
We're eating oil. And in addition to all that, when the oil price goes up, and since gasoline is a necessity, you have less left to spend on other things, including paying for your mortgage.
Exactly.
And that's exacerbating. That's making the housing crisis worse. So they don't want to talk about oil price because it's controlled by big oil and oil companies pay for the campaign election donations and so on. So they don't
yeah,
talk about all that.
What year was it that your book Greenspan's Fraud came out?
That came out in 2005.
2005. So that was, I think it was right after that book came out that it was the first time that you were on our program.
That's right. And at that time, that man was at the height of his popularity.
That's right. And you came on our program and you said, you predicted all these things. You said this kind of Reaganomics, well, that Reaganomics is my word, not yours, but these policies that were initiated under, basically under the Reagan administration of, you know, Cheney said, you know, Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. Well, deficits do matter. And I think one of the most interesting things that I've learned from you, we're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, New York Times bestselling author of you know, any number of books. So check out his website, ravibatra.com, and you can, of course, go to any of the online sellers or any bookstore and find his books, is this notion that the monetarists, you know, Milton Friedman and Frederick von Hayek and Tom Friedman, for that matter, these days, that they have it all wrong, and that the equation that we should be looking at is the relationship between the productivity of workers and the wages of workers.
Exactly. You said it just on.
Please explain that a little bit.
Yeah, right on dot. Because in the end, every economy is guided by supply and demand. Supply and demand are like two wings of an airplane, and both wings have to be of equal weight, of equal length, so that the airplane keeps flying. Otherwise, if one side becomes lighter than the other, then the plane will be wobbly first and then crash. So supply and demand are the two essential forces guiding an economy. Now, the main source of supply is productivity. Productivity
right.
is the main source of supply. Wages are the main source of demand. Now, productivity
and both come out of workers.
But that's right. Wages are that's right. Demand comes from workers, and demand, workers also are producers on the other side. See, productivity from workers and wages for workers. These are the two main sources of supply and demand.
Now, this is what Roosevelt understood. He got this, and so he said, okay, the economy's in the tank. What are we going to do? We're going to increase demand by creating jobs for people, even if they're make work jobs, essentially, you know, replanting forests, building bridges, building dams, things that arguably could have been postponed, even if we had to borrow the money to hire them, and putting that money in the pockets of workers then created the demand that caused entrepreneurs like myself and business people, people who started businesses, to say, hey, there's enough money out there, there's demand for something, I think I'll start a factory making widgets because people want to buy widgets now that they've got some disposable income.
That's
and
right.
Boom, the economy, we had the fastest growth, the largest and strongest industrial economy in the history of the world in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s.
That's
and then
right.
Reagan comes along and says, oh, no, that's all wrong. It's all about supply. It's not about demand. And we went to supply-side economics, and now over 30 years, we've destroyed this economy.
Ever since then, they have been creating extra demand through debt, not through higher wages.
That's right.
Supply is rising because of rising productivity. Wages are not. So how do you create extra demand? They have been doing it by creating more and more debt, government debt on one side and consumer debt on the other side.
Right.
But there's a limit to which debt can rise, and now that limit has been reached. So now we are at the breaking point, and they still want to create more debt. That's the amazing part.
Yeah.
That's
what the Germans did in the 1920s after the Treaty of Versailles said that they had to repay the European countries for the damage of World War One. They couldn't afford to pay back the Treaty of Versailles. So what did they do? They started printing money like crazy. They reduced the value of their currency, because the debt was denominated in marks. They said you had to pay back, you know, a billion marks or 10 trillion marks or whatever it was. I don't know what the amount was under the Treaty of Versailles. So the Germans just said, okay, cool. We'll make a million marks worth what today 5 marks is worth. And you reached a point where it took a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a loaf of bread, but they were able to pay off their debt.
And that's what they're doing now. They just bailed out Bear Stearns. Now they're talking about bailing out home builders, home buyers. Now, bailing out home buyers would at least make some sense.
Yeah, because then it's at the level of the consumer where demand is generated.
Exactly, right.
So if people, and they have been encouraging, because they are unwilling to allow wages to rise, which would be the solution to all these problems,
right,
is simply let wages rise in parallel with productivity, which would put the average worker's wages, you know, probably about twice where they are right now, I would guess.
Well, yeah, that's right. Well, see, in 1969, our minimum wage in terms of today's prices was about $9 per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And all these, like Greenspan used to say, and many other administration economists say, that high minimum wages create people out of jobs. Well, guess what? In 1969, our unemployment rate was the lowest in history, 3.5%.
Right. And the higher the minimum wage goes, and we've seen this in state after state. Here in Oregon, we have a very high minimum wage. And what happened when we raised our minimum wage? Unemployment went down, employment went up, and economic activity went up. Well, let our listeners get in on this, and we'll be taking your calls for Dr. Ravi Batra at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nothing to fear but fear itself.
Just as long as you stand by me.
And thanks for standing with us. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable for the in the fight for worker safety. Find out more at Teamster.org. 21 minutes past the hour, we are talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, the author of multiple New York Times international best-selling books, including Greenspan's Fraud, The New Golden Age, The Myth of Free Trade, The Great American Deception, and others. And Dr. Batra, can we take some phone calls here?
Sure.
Okay, great. Paul in Fort Lauderdale, listening on WINZ on WINZ. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I own or hold some of these auction-rate preferred shares, and I'm just curious what the gentleman thinks my prospects are of getting my becoming liquid again. I'm now totally illiquid.
In other words, you can't sell them. Your broker has told you that you're stuck. And what did they originally tell you, that this was, you know, as good as cash?
Absolutely. That's how they were sold. Yes.
Yeah. Dr.
Yeah,
Batra?
I think they are still paying interest regularly, but you can't get rid of them. I have a friend who has the same thing, same problem. If things stabilize for even 1 or 2 months, then you might be able to get them back. But I don't see them stabilizing quickly, even now. But if they do stabilize, I think there are good chances of getting.
Should he have a standing sell order with his broker,
maybe piecemeal, sell them piecemeal, not all at the same time, because yeah, perhaps there will be losses.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Paul, thank you very much for the call and for the question. And of course, we're not offering individual investment advice here. I don't think either one of us are licensed investment
advisors.
Yeah,
we're just looking at common sense.
Yeah. You're an economist and I'm a talk show host, but we will discuss the issues here. And so, in fact, let's ask questions in a broader context, like what should one do rather than what should I do? Dawn in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Dawn.
Hi, Tom. My question is, I'm looking to buy some gold through ITM Trading, who advertises on your, and I just wanted to know right now if that's a good move.
Gold is still a good buy, I think, but it may not rise quickly in the next 3-4 months because it has really come up. It has gone up sharply, but before you buy gold, see, it's hard to recommend any brokerage who you can trust. That's the trouble nowadays. But before you buy gold, there are some gold stocks. You can buy those stocks and then sell options on them at the same time, which will protect you from any loss. I mean, which will give you some protection from a loss. And once you have the stock, then the stock will rise in the future. That's my advice.
That's
what I'm doing, so I know what I'm doing, so that's what I'm telling you.
Okay. Stacy in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Stacy,
well,
you're live with
morning.
Dr. Ravi Batra. Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Batra, I live in West Los Angeles where the real estate market is still very, very strong, and we're about to sell our house and walk away with a large sum of money, and we don't want to buy another house right now, and I'm really concerned about what the safest thing to do with the money would be.
I think I would put them in different CDs of big banks.
Thank you, Stacey.
And spread the money out.
At a maximum of $100,000 per bank, are we at the point where we really can't trust the banks? The FDIC guarantees $100,000 per bank, right?
Per account, per single account, for a joint account, the product protection is up to $200,000. If both can withdraw money at any point.
Okay.
If they have joint account.
If she has $400,000, she should open, or not necessarily her, but, you know, if somebody had $400,000, they should, in your opinion, they should open a savings account
or a CD account in two different
banks.
Two or three CDs in different banks, right. And ask
what
kind of protection they have on FDIC. The maximum protection is $200,000.
Yeah, okay. This is downright spooky in places. Ed in Wichita, Texas. We have about a minute before this next break here, Ed. What's up?
I wanted to ask if we had to tank out the whole economy, if we wanted to make a paradigm shift off of oil to something like electricity.
Well, I have suggested how we can bring down the price of oil. The price of oil is not a mystery why it's rising. It's rising because there's monopoly. There are regional monopolies in that industry. In the 1990s, there were 2,500 mergers in that industry. 2,500 mergers.
Wow.
So what the oil companies did, they closed down gas stations. ExxonMobil has closed down most of the mobile stations, so now you have only Exxon. Chevron Texaco stations were closed down, only Chevron was left. So the result was there was no more competition among gas stations. So they kept raising prices at risk.
So it's become just a giant monopoly.
So break it down. Break down these companies just as we did.
Plus they're denominating oil in dollars. And I want to pick up that topic when we come back, and we'll continue to take calls. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com, his website, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, and author of The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Ravi Batra on the line with us, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, international best-selling, New York Times best-selling author of numerous books, including The Myth of Free Trade, The Great American Deception, Greenspan's Fraud, The New Golden Age. Dr. Batra, we're taking calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here, David in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Yeah, thank you guys very much for bringing up this topic. I just wanted to put the question, what do we do about the undue influence that the Kuwaitis could potentially have on our economy, since we're basically mortgaging out all of our investment banks to them?
The whom?
The Kuwaiti.
The Kuwaiti government?
The Kuwaiti that are infusing money into America.
Oh, well, really, it's all these sovereign wealth funds that are coming into the United States, is it not? I mean, Dr. Batra, I guess the question, we've got governments all over the world that are accumulating massive amounts of money in large part because of our economic stupidity over the last 30 years, and now they're starting to buy up our companies.
That's right. I mean, we mentioned the price of oil before, and because the price of oil is so high, that's why countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait have a lot of money. They don't know what to do with it. They're essentially using our money to buy back our businesses, and we have raised the price of oil for them. This time, you know, OPEC is not to blame. This time it's the monopolistic oil industry in the United States is doing it. I mean, you hear it again and again that high oil demand from India and China is responsible for the high price of oil, but China has been growing very fast since 1980. So, and at the same time, consumption of oil is rising every year.
Now, I understand that in 72, when Nixon took us off the gold standard, or 73, that he cut a deal with the Saudis that, and this was, you know, part of the rationale, that if oil, that they would exclusively denominate oil and OPEC along with them in dollars, and that gave Nixon the comfort to take our currency off one commodity, gold, and put it essentially on another commodity, oil. And that's another great danger to our currency, is that the only thing stabilizing our currency over the last 30 years or 40 years since Nixon did this has been the worldwide supply and price of oil. And now oil is starting to reflect the debasement of our currency as a result of Reaganomics.
Well, that's right. And so this now we are in a vicious circle, caught in a vicious circle. As dollar falls, oil goes up.
Right.
As oil goes up, dollar falls more. So this is, we're in a really very, very tough situation. And so in order to take us out of the current crisis, we have to take some short-term measures and some long-term measures. The short-term measures would be, of course, bailing out some of the home buyers and raising the minimum wage sharply. And the long-term measure would be to break up the oil industry into smaller units. And we have done this in the past. We did that in 1911, broke up Standard Oil into 16 smaller companies, not one or two, 16 smaller companies. So we can do that again.
Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster.
I don't know who did that. 1911.
Yeah, I think it was. I think okay. Roosevelt was president. But well, I may be wrong. But in any case, yeah, exactly. Weldon in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hi, Dr. Batra. Got so many questions. I don't know where to start. But I was just going to ask this latest decision or this latest announcement by Paulson about the Fed. Isn't that in essence a power coup that has been taken by the Fed over Congress?
Yeah, this is the question I was asking on the program last time, and thank you, Walden, on the question last week, Dr. Batra, and that is, the Fed is a private corporation, and the Republicans and the conservatives are saying, let's give more control over our economy, more regulatory control to this private corporation, and let's shut down the Securities and Exchange Commission, which Roosevelt put into place in '33 to protect us from the sharks.
Yeah, this is crazy. I think they dismantled that Glass-Steagall Act, which separated the banks from the rest of the financial industry.
Yes, this was in 1998. Bill Clinton signed that legislation
That
did away with Glass-Steagall.
And now we are seeing the horrible results of financial deregulation. So it's one thing to deregulate the airlines or some other industries, but deregulating the banking system, financial system is very dangerous because in this industry, people are playing with other people's money.
Yeah.
They don't have their own money at risk. They may have some of that own money at risk, but they're playing with other people's money. And then initially they make huge profits, a large part of which goes into their own pockets, but at the same time they put the entire system at risk. That was the problem. We should bring that Glass-Steagall Act back, and then we don't need all these other giving more powers to the Fed, which is essentially, as you said, a private corporation.
Right, and also start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act again that Reagan stopped the enforcement of in 1983.
Well, that's how we will break the oil companies.
That's right, but it's not just the oil companies. Break up
that's
big
right.
banking, break up big media, break up big, fill in the blank, big defense contractors.
Pharmaceuticals,
yeah, right across the board. You want to see the economy start working right again. Take us back to pre-1982 pre-1981 when Reagan stopped, I think it was 82 when he more or less officially stopped enforcing Sherman Antitrust Act. And we saw this wave of mergers and acquisitions and people like Michael Milken, these M&A artists, mergers and acquisitions artists, a brand new phrase in our lexicon suddenly became the emperors of industry. Mark in Denver, Colorado, you're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hi. Dr. Batra, I have a question for you. When I think of economic matters, I use the model of the human circulatory system, and I like to think that blood or blood plasma makes a good analog for money. Is that a off base to use that?
Well, by the way, I mean, before we don't have that much time left, but lots of questions that people are asking, I've answered them in The New Golden Age. The New Golden Age is the book that has a lot of answers. Greenspan's Fraud also has some of these answers, especially about Social Security and so on.
Yeah.
This is your book, I guess, right?
Yes, by Dr. Ravi Batra.
Thanks.
So
I didn't understand the question.
So his question is,
I think that the plasma in the blood,
that's
the purpose of transport in the circulatory system. So
yeah, the circulation is very important. When money becomes static, doesn't move among the people, that's when the problems arise, and that's what's happening because of extremely concentrated wealth. Money is in the hands of a very small group of people, and it's not circulating with the rest of the economy or in the rest among the workers, and that's creating the congestion of the system essentially,
right.
And that's the problem.
Yeah, I understand you have to leave. Can you stick around for another three or four minutes here until the next break,
okay.
Dr. Batra?
Sure.
Okay, great, thank you. Quinn in Sun Valley or Sunnyvale, California. Excuse me, listening on Green 960. Hey, Quinn, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Yes, hi. I'm a student, and I'm currently taking a macroeconomics class, and my professor has been touting the greatness of supply-side economics. We went through talking about classical economics and Keynesian economics and the downsides of that, but he forgot to mention any of the negative aspects of supply-side economics, and I would just like to give us a quick rundown of maybe the negative aspects or what has, if it's caused problems with what we have today? Is there anything specific?
It's the supply. You see, my Greenspan's fraud has two chapters on supply side economics, and it shows what it has done. I will not give you theory. I'll give you some facts about what we were before supply side economics and after. Before supply side economics, our growth rate was 4% per year. After they introduced it, it has come down to 3% per year. Before that, over 200 years, we had accumulated $1 trillion in government debt. Since then, it's $10 trillion in government debt, and still we have a lower growth rate. Wages were rising at the rate of 2% per year before. Now they have been falling at the rate of 1% per year, I mean the real wage. Supply-side economics, theoretically and in terms of facts, is a bogus system. And if you really want to answer somebody, just read Greenspan's Fraud. It will give you all the answers against supply-side economics.
It's an absolutely marvelous book, and it's one of my absolute favorites. Okay, we have 1 minute left. Cliff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Yes, sir, Dr. Batra. I'll make it quick. Do you have any books or anything you can recommend? I missed the fact of where would you put money if you had money in an IRA right now?
The new Golden Age.
The new Golden Age.
We'll give you some suggestions.
All right. The other thing I wanted to mention, you said about banks. And $100,000 limit. The banks have a program, many of them, where you just go to the one bank, they will split your $100,000 deposits up among multiple banks to protect you.
I wouldn't do that.
You would not do that?
No, I wouldn't do that.
Because it's under the control of one bank?
I would keep under my control and select two or three banks.
Yeah, because this is more of the, you know, give us your money. We'll take care
right.
of it. We'll, you know, and it's like all these folks with these auction rate funds. Yeah, who are experiencing the exact same thing. Dr. Ravi Batra, the website ravibatra.com, and his books, his most recent books, Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age. I highly recommend them. Both of them have been my BuzzFlash books of the month over the last couple of years. And you can get them at buzzflash.com, at any bookstore, on any of the book signs, sites, ravibatra.com. Dr. Batra, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Professor of Economics at Southern Methodist University. It's 44 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
A fella stopped and offered to give my car a tow just because I was stuck in a ditch in the mud a couple feet or so. I said, have some faith, boy. Don't treat me like I'm stuck. I'll be out of here shortly with just a little doggone luck because I'm making progress. That's my attitude. You say you can't quite feel it? Don't bring me down now, dude. You think that I'm deluded? You think my facts ain't real? Well, we're making progress. That's just the way I feel.
And welcome back. Friday. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Saturday. John McCain saying, yeah, he's clearly, obviously committed to quality education for GIs, but no, he's not signing on to the new GI Bill here. Even though it's bipartisan, well, Chuck Hagel is supporting it, and Chuck Hagel, they say, he's not a real Republican. He's opposed to the war, and he thinks that Bush is, well, whatever. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Dr. Batra has, he had to get back to his teaching duties there at Southern Methodist University. But I'm still here, Rick in San Luis Obispo. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, I wondered, and since you're on top of this, maybe you could tell me, why no economists are talking about the fact that the economy was just fine before both of the last downturns until the Federal Reserve started relentlessly raising interest rates until the economy came to a standstill, and then they waited before lowering them until things got really bad.
Ravi Batra writes about this in Greenspan's Fraud. I wrote about it in Screwed. If you go back to 1990... I think it was either 93 or 97. Alan Greenspan, and I've got the quote in my book Screwed, I don't know if it's in Dr. Batra's book, but the Wall Street Journal interviewed him and asked what he thought his principal job was as chairman of the Fed. And he said that his principal job as chairman of the Fed was to restrain wage inflation. He felt the increase in wages was the most dangerous thing that could happen to the economy. And that he did this by, and this is a verbatim quote, by maintaining a certain minimum level of worker insecurity, end of quote. Mm-hmm. In other words, his job, whenever the economy started to heat up to the point where there was demand for workers, and that demand would cause workers to be able to say, yeah, I'll work for you for a buck more than you're offering. In other words, we started to have an increase in wages that paralleled the increase in productivity. Whenever Greenspan saw that happen, he would crank up interest rates to slow down the economy so that there wouldn't be an increase in wages. And as Ravi Batra points out in all of his books, and he's so right on this, and as John Maynard Keynes pointed out long ago, and frankly, Adam Smith pointed out, if wages don't increase at the same rate that productivity increases, and productivity has increased dramatically in the United States over the years, in part because of things like automation and computers and whatnot, but in part because people have just become more productive, if wages don't increase at the same rate productivity does, then the economy throws itself out of balance. And if wages are not increasing at the same rate as productivity is, then people can't keep up. So demand starts to dry up. If demand starts to dry up, the economy starts going into the tank. So when they shifted to supply side economics with Reagan in 81, as wages started going down, and Reagan, you know, essentially declared war on the American middle class, And as a result, started dropping. You know, when he busted PATCO, declared war on the unions. As a result of that, wages have been steadily declining ever since Reagan became president, and at a rate, real wages at a rate of about 1% a year, as Dr. Batra pointed out. And so, the question for the guys in the administration, in the Reagan administration, in the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, and the Bush administration, is if wages aren't going up. And wages are what give people enough money to buy things, thus creating demand, which is what fuels the economy. If wages aren't going up, how can we keep people buying things? And the easy solution is, let's give them access to credit that they didn't have before. I mean, I remember when I got my first American Express card, it was like 1972, 73. I was in my early 20s. I owned a business. I was making, actually at the time, more money than my dad was making. It was a cool thing, but it required an enormous amount of good credit for me to get an American Express card. And it was my first credit card. And I was like 22 years old. And back then, it was really hard to get a mortgage. And it was hard to get a credit card. And it was hard to get credit. And so what they did is they just opened up the spigot. Now my cat gets credit card applications. So that's what they did, is they drove demand with credit. And as Dr. Batra pointed out, we have reached the limit of the amount of credit that we can offer, both to the government. The government is now $10 trillion in debt, plus our balance of payments deficit, the trade deficit on top of that, and individuals. You know, the average American family now is over $7,000 in debt, just in credit card debt. And then on top of that, you know, household debt, people have been using their homes as ATMs for the last 20 years. And it's looked like things are prosperous. As I said, during the Reagan administration, you know, he said, you know, look how great the economy is. Well, he took us from a $1 trillion debt to a $3.5, almost $4 trillion debt in 8 years. He ran up more debt than every president from George Washington to Ronald Reagan combined. Ronald Reagan ran up more debt than the combined debt of the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. He ran up more debt than all of that and spent that money on things like the Star Wars thing and other crazy things to transfer that money to his buddies and in the, you know, big campaign contributors to the Republicans, and said, hey, look at this. It's trickling down to the economy. Isn't it great? And I said, you know, give me a $1 trillion credit card. I'll show you what it looks like to live large. But the bottom line is that the bill for that is on us and our children and our grandchildren. And as that bill becomes due, it's going to wipe out this country. Or not is going to. It is right now. The bill is coming due right now. And the conservatives and the Republicans and these conservative economists who bought into the supply side thing, in many cases because it was in their own self-interest, because they were aligned with the banking industry or the securities industry, These people who are running around preaching this stuff are, you know, running around with their hands over their heads. You know, oh my God, you know, what are we going to do? And they're like putting bubble gum and masking tape on the cracks in this giant dam that is holding back all this debt, hoping that maybe if a Democrat gets elected president after November or after January, they'll pull the tape off and they'll let the dam explode and they'll let all hell break loose and say, see, we told you those Democrats were no good. I mean, that's, frankly, in my opinion, the political game plan here that's being played. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Daryl Issa. I mean, this is how crazy these guys get. Daryl Issa, the congressman from California, the guy who initially, with his own money, funded the effort to get Gray Davis recalled in California because he thought he was going to run for governor and get it. And then when Arnold got into the race, broke down in tears at a news conference, watching his dreams disintegrate. Daryl Issa saying, well, you know, the federal government has given enough money to New York City for 9/11. Yeah, we got these people. I mean, these aren't his words. This is the essence of what he said. Well, here's actually the exact words that he said. He said that New York... This from the New York Daily News. I'll just read it straight. These are two sentences from the New York Daily News. The California congressman who called the September 11 attacks simply a plane crash ran for cover Wednesday under a barrage of ridicule from fellow Republicans, first responders, and victims' families. San Diego GOP Representative Daryl Issa was under siege for suggesting the federal government had already done enough to help New York cope with, quote, a fire, end quote, that, quote, simply was an aircraft, end quote, hitting the World Trade Center. End of excerpt from the New York Daily News. This is the conservative world. We don't need to help folks out. Yeah, there's these first responders, and yes, they have asbestosis and diseases of the lungs and cancers and all these kinds of things from working in that environment. Yeah, Rudy Giuliani lied to them about whether or not the air was clean. Yeah, Christy Todd Whitman, the EPA, she lied to them about whether the air was clean. The Bush administration lied to them about whether the air was safe, and they went in there and did, you know, an extraordinary and wonderful and valiant job of trying to save lives and trying to recover victims. But, you know, we don't owe them anything. We're Republicans. We got our money. The Daryl Issa worldview. The Daryl Issa worldview as it spreads to Iraq, by the way. Michael Ware sat down with the folks over at the Center for American Progress. You can see this over at thinkprogress.org in their wonk room. Michael Ware, the CNN reporter, to talk about what's going on in Baghdad. And this is the take-home line from this.
If anyone is telling you that the cleansing of Baghdad has not contributed to the fall in violence, then they either simply do not understand Baghdad, or they're lying to you.
Or they're lying to you. In other words, he points out that violence has dropped in Baghdad. Why? Because the city has been ethnically cleansed. All the mixed neighborhoods are gone. They are just absolutely gone. I mean, he just lays this out.
The sectarian cleansing of Baghdad has been, albeit tragic, one of the key elements to the drop in sectarian violence in the capital. Now, the US military says that violence has fallen by as much as 97% over the past year. And it's certainly true that we're not finding the dozens of bodies on the streets tortured and mutilated each morning that we once were.
And this, he points out, is because the neighborhoods have been separated. They've got blast barriers, they've got barbed wire. It's like Belfast in the 70s. I mean, these neighborhoods have been segregated from each other, so people can't get at each other. They can't kill each other. And the upshot of this is, yeah, of course, sectarian violence is down. But is this any way to live? I mean, is this the democracy that we fought to bring to Iraq? I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Michael Ware continues.
Now, it's a number of factors, but the cleansing of Baghdad is definitely a part of it. It's a very simple concept. Baghdad has been divided, segregated into Sunni and Shia enclaves.
And he points out that the Shia enclaves are supported by the Mahdi army and of course, Sadr, the Mahdi army's leader, is in Iran right now studying to become a mullah. And they're associated with Iran. And the Sunni groups, in some cases, are saying, yeah, we're al-Qaeda in Iraq. You know, it's not Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda. It's their local version of it. Or, I mean, that's basically the Sunni insurgency.
The days of mixed neighborhoods are gone. They're literally protected by either Iranian-backed or U.S.-backed militias who night and day guard those neighborhoods to prevent rival death squads, be they in government uniforms or be they under al-Qaeda banners, coming in and taking victims. They're also walled off, literally, by massive concrete blast barriers that the U.S. forces put in place.
So we went in and we separated this area. Now, in the meantime, John McCain is running around saying, well, you know, it's in the interest of al-Qaeda to see Iran fall. Excuse me, John McCain did not say that. Ayman al-Zawahiri said that. Let me start this over again. John McCain saying it's in the interest of the United States to see Iran fall. John McCain promoting the idea of bomb, 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 bomb Iran. And Ayman al-Zawahiri, the guy who really was the first into Afghanistan, he came out of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and which all of this really started, oddly enough, for this guy Qutb in the United States in the 1950s. And for that, I commend to you Adam Curtis's brilliant documentary, The Power of Nightmares, which you can Google and you can watch on. It's a BBC documentary, a three-hour documentary. You can watch it online. And he just documents the arc of the growth of, on the one hand, the neoconservative movement in the United States, which also began in the United States in the 1950s with Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago. And Mr. Qutb, as I recall, it was in St. Louis, Missouri. And he went back to Egypt and said, you know, the West is falling apart. It's all decadent. The men and women are dancing together. He went to a square dance, and this is what so horrified him. Men and women are dancing together. We can't have that. And he founded the Muslim Brotherhood. He was executed by Sadat. His people then killed the president of Egypt. And the Muslim Brotherhood, Ayman al-Zawahiri became the head of this. And then he went to Afghanistan and he took under his wing a student, Osama bin Laden, a guy who had come from Saudi Arabia to be a freedom fighter against the Russians. And Zawahiri really is the mentor of Osama bin Laden. He's a pediatrician, by the way, and he's about 10 years older or 15 years older than bin Laden. And so McCain's saying, we need to take down the government in Iran. Zawahiri just came out and said, great. It's in the interest of al-Qaeda to see Iran fail. He said the dispute between America and Iran is a real dispute based on the struggle over areas of influence, the possibility of America striking Iran is a real possibility. As for what might happen in the region, I can only say that major changes will occur in the region. The situation will be in the interest of the Mujahideen. That's how he refers to al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. If the war saps both of them. If, however, one of them emerges victorious, its influence will intensify. And fierce battles would begin between it and the Mujahideen, except that the jihadi awakening currently underway and the degeneration state of affairs of the invaders in Afghanistan and Iraq will make it impossible for Iran or America to become the sole decision maker in the region. So here you've got, you know, McCain going out there making these totally irrational, you know, let's take down Iran points and saying, oh, Iraq is a great victory. And Michael Ware saying, well, yeah, a great victory if you like segregated neighborhoods. Michael Ware, again, the reporter from CNN, talking to the folks from the Center for American Progress.
So what's happened is that the cleansing of Baghdad means there's simply less people to kill. And of those who remain, they're much harder for a death squad to get to.
So therefore, we're going to declare victory and go home? In the meantime, 4 million refugees. This is the world's second largest refugee crisis behind the one that I saw 3 weeks ago in Darfur, Sudan. 4 million refugees, 2 million people internally displaced, 2 million, 2.5 million people who have fled the country, probably as many as 1 million people who have died in Iraq. And just in Syria alone, just in Damascus alone, the best guess is that there's 55,000 women, many of them teenagers and younger, who are now working as prostitutes because it's the only way to support their families. And this has become the sex tourism center. Syria has become the sex tourism center for all of the Gulf states. As a consequence of this tragedy. I mean, somebody should lay this at the doorstep of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and Bill Kristol and all these neocons and Fox News. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
They are the Tom Hartman radio program, and time for a rush alert.
Condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am.
Well, so Rush goes off yesterday on the feminists who are supporting Hillary. I mean, Rush is without even getting into his personal life, such a friend of women, you know, after all.
You have to understand the mindset of a lot of these feminists and women. They think they're owed this, just like Obama supporters think they're owed this. These women have paid their dues. They've been married two or three times. They've had two or three abortions. They've done everything that feminism asked them to do. They have cut men out of their lives. They have devoted themselves to causes and careers and this.
Yeah, and on he goes. I mean, you know, enough already, Rush. I mean, this is the guy who said,
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
Yeah, so polarizing people saying, oh, it's either because people are African-American or because they're female. That's the only reason that they'd support anything. This is going to be these are going to be the Republican talking points, regardless of which one of these two candidates is the nominee. And it's sick and twisted, I'm telling you. It's absolutely sick and twisted.
Each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob.
Yeah, our Rush alert for the day. This is 23 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our number. Robert, New York City. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask one question, one big question, one small question. I've heard a couple pundits when the Bear Stearns thing was going on, and financial pundits say that at the bottom line, if everything doesn't work out, that the Federal Reserve can always print more money. And I was just wondering, what does that actually mean? What does that do to the concept of money, and how can they just do that? How come nobody has said anything about that?
Well, what the, you know, actually, yeah, I think it would be the Treasury Department that would be doing that, but the Fed does control the money supply to a large extent, and through the fractional banking system, and by changing interest rates, they change the amount of money that's available, because see, every time money is put into deposit, 10 times that amount of money can be loaned out. So money is essentially created as deposits are generated, even if those deposits are borrowed money. So borrowed money just kind of echoes down through the system. The bottom line result of it is that it destroys the currency. It causes what's called inflation. It's the reason why, you know, when the Fed came into being in 1913, you could buy a loaf of bread with 4 or 5 cents, and today it takes, you know, a couple of dollars.
But how can they say that that's can solve the problem that they can?
It doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't solve the problem. What it does is it cosmetically solves the problem. It makes it look like the problem's not there. But what it is really is it's a tax on everybody who's not so rich that it doesn't matter to them if the value of their currency and the value of their holdings drops by 5, 10, 15, 20, 30%. You know, if somebody's got $50 million in the bank and now their purchasing power is the equivalent of $30 million, it's probably not that big a deal. But if somebody's making $40,000 a year, $50,000 a year, I think the median income in the United States is like $46,000. If somebody's living at that level and they're just getting by, and suddenly their cost of living goes up 10% because the value of the currency that they're being paid in has gone down 10%, and their wages don't go up by that 10%, then they're in big trouble. And that's what's happening. That's what we've been seeing happening throughout this whole process. And that, you know, thus all the more is the disaster. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Since a lot of this problem has been the changes in the ARMs, you know, the mortgage interest rates gone up on adjustable rate mortgages, why can't the companies hold the interest rate back and help save themselves and help save the homeowners?
In other words, why don't the banks who have written contracts that say after the second year we can jack up your interest rate, why don't they just not jack up the interest rates?
Yes.
Well, because they wouldn't make as much profit.
Yeah,
they sold.
No, what this anyway.
But see, what happened is those banks packaged those loans and said this bundle of loans is worth $10 million. The $10 million valuation on that bundle of loans that they then sold out in the marketplace was based on the assumption that those interest rates would go up. And so if those interest rates start not going up, then the value of those securities that the bank sold starts declining. And so then you've got people coming back to the bank and having the legal basis to actually sue the banks, saying you're not fulfilling on the obligation of the security that you sold to me. I mean, the investor class could be suing the banking class for not putting the homeowner class, you know, out of their homes. And and that's why it's not happening, Jeff.
I heard the BBC, Sony of the BBC put it nicely about saying that we've got socialism for the rich now and capitalism for the poor.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. Capitalism for the poor and socialism for the rich. And well said. Jeff, thanks a lot for listening. 26 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. When George was back to region, a heavenly message he was sent to give $1 trillion back to the upper 1%. Some 40 million people here ain't got no health insurer. But the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. How did this country get so bad now? How did this country get so bad?
Reagan had something to do with it. And then Bush. And then the other Bush. And, you know, Bill Clinton did some good, and he also signed the Glass-Steagall Act, which, and the Telecommunications Act, and a few other things. Anyway, basically, it all started with Reagan. 34 minutes past the hour, Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress. the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website, and also the editor of MikeCheckRadio.org, is on the line with us. And Christy, hey, welcome.
How are you? I always get tricked by your songs. I always find myself sort of dancing along and thinking, oh, this is such a great song. And I'm like, oh, wait, this is really depressing and about how bad things are. Gotcha.
Yeah,
every week you do that, too.
Louise does our bumper music, and she and a lot of our listeners send us stuff, and she finds stuff out there on the internets and whatnot. And,
oh, it's great. It's great. Just,
she's brilliant at it. A year ago, year and a half ago, I was, every year I do the CPAC convention, the Conservative Political Action.
Oh yeah, I love that thing.
And yeah, I do too. It's like going to the circus, you know, or you know, watching
yeah.
the freak show. And for 3 hours a day, for 3 days, I will broadcast live from there, and it's just one conservative after another coming up to debate me and try to take me on. And not at the last one that I did, which was what 2 months ago, I think it was when I was in Washington D.C., but a year ago then, John Yoo got up and debated with Bob Barr. Now, I've known Bob Barr back from when he was a congressman in Georgia, and I don't know him well. It's not like we're close friends or anything, but you know, we did have a beer together once years ago at the Mamaloo's Tavern in Georgia, you know, when he was a congressman from there. And,
yeah.
And we've had many conversations, both on the air and off the air, both on this show and also on National Public Radio, where we have debated over the last 5 years or so. And Bob Barr is a genuine and principled libertarian, actually. I
was going
to say conservative,
right.
But he calls himself a libertarian. And frankly, I think he's a decent human being, although I disagree with most of his politics. He got up and he was introduced as the guy who led the Clinton impeachment and, you know, conservative congressman from Georgia. And the crowd just loved him and they applauded for him. And John Yoo was introduced as the professor from Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, and the crowd booed him. And then John Yoo proceeded to go into this rant about how our civil liberties, how 9/11 changed everything, and civil liberties are not in the Constitution, and the right to not be tortured, and the right to not be followed, and the rights of privacy are not actually categorically guaranteed by the Constitution. And Bob Barr proceeded to try and take that apart, to say, yes, they are guaranteed by the Constitution, and what the Bush administration has been doing is destroying the Constitution, and the crowd turned. The 3,500 people in that audience started booing Bob Barr and applauding John Yoo.
Oh, that makes me feel a little sick inside.
Yeah, it was horrifying. I was stunned.
Because
I frankly expected that the crowd would be with Bob Barr. They weren't. They were with John Yoo. And now we're discovering that John Yoo, his influence on this administration was far greater than we ever imagined.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, before I talk about these two new memos, I've got to tell you, Tom, you've got to get your hands on the new Vanity Fair magazine. It's online, this article that I'm about to talk about, and it's also in the magazine that came out yesterday. In just sort of a weird twist of fate, the same day these memos came out, Vanity Fair published this article that really walks you through everything we know about the White House march to commit torture. It is one of the most disturbing yet fascinating articles I've ever read. It's a must read this week. It's basically a timeline that shows that unlike what the White House and the Defense Department has tried to say, which is that all of the torture we've seen was sort of dirt up, is how they put it, that it was a few bad apples on the ground that
right. It was all in Lindy England or whatever.
Right. Yeah. This actually goes through everything they knew up until these two new memos, actually, about how it started at the top and trickled down for torture. Very, very good. But, yes, there are these two memos, both of which were penned by you.
By John Yoo.
Not you.
Who's on first?
No. I'll say John Yoo
for now. No, not who you.
To stop any confusion.
We need to get John Yoo and the president of China, you know, Hu Hintao, in the same room.
Who you?
Who you? No, you. Yeah, no, who?
Oh, well. Yeah, no, John Yoo was the number two guy over at the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department.
Yes.
And he's most famous up until this point because he's the guy who actually wrote what we know as the Bybee memo, which is the memo that said that it was only considered torture if the guy you were torturing died or had organ failure.
Right.
So that's how we knew him up until now. So yesterday,
which then would not be torture; it would be murder.
Well, right. But oh, that's just a legal distinction with this White House.
Well, we know of over 30 people who died while being tortured.
That's true.
In U.S. custody. I mean,
that is true.
I think 34 was the last number that I saw for documented that the Defense Department admits to.
Right. Well, this memo came out yesterday, and it was just mind-blowing. More mind-blowing was the fact that it's not, you know, covering all news coverage today, because I think it should. But this memo that came out yesterday was a secret memo from 2003 in which John Yoo basically outlined a structure by which the president was outside all law. There was language in there that said the president during wartime did not have to abide by the Fifth Amendment or the Eighth Amendment. So, in fact, President Bush is above the Constitution. It said President Bush did not have to follow international law because it didn't count in times of war, even though that's why we have international law. It said that interrogators were exempt from ever being prosecuted for torturing people because actually anything they did was a matter of self-defense for the nation. Crazy stuff in this memo. So as if that wasn't bad enough, someone sat down and, thank goodness, combed through the footnotes and found evidence of yet another secret memo that we don't know about. This one's still classified, but hidden in the footnotes of yesterday's Yoo memo, John Yoo memo, was a mention of a different memo from October 2001. That said that for at least 16 months after the 9/11 attacks, the Bush administration said that the Constitution protection against unreasonable search and seizures on U.S. soil did not apply.
Wow. Wow. And let's keep in mind that John Yoo at that time was the number two guy in the Office of Legal Counsel. His boss was, as I recall, Alberto Gonzalez.
Right. Well, he was first with the John Ashcroft regime.
Or was it Harriet Myers? Who was
attorney? This is over at Justice. So he is part of the Justice Department. So boss is, you're right, Gonzalez. He also worked very closely with Haynes, the other torture memo guy that President Bush is always pushing for a promotion these days, who finally stepped down a couple of months ago. So, yeah, it's really, really damaging and horrible things. Oh, the memo also said that torture isn't torture unless you went into it specifically meaning it to be torture.
Yeah, now he says that this is all because of in time of war. And I'd just like to share with our listeners James Madison, his comments on war. This was April 20th, 1795. And he had just finished shepherding the Constitution and the Bill of Rights through the Constitutional Congress, was just preparing to. And no, he just finished. It was 9 years later. And he said, and I quote, there's just three sentences here. He says, "In war, too, the discretionary power of the president is extended. It's his influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and morals engendered by both. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare."
Wow.
This is the man who fought the War of 1812.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I mean, Bush talks about, well, we always thought oceans could protect us. I'm sorry, in 1812, the British came over and burned the White House!
Exactly.
It's not like we haven't been attacked before on our own soil. It's like, but John Hughes seems to think that, you know, he's spitting on the grave of James Madison. It's
Well, and not only
insane.
That, these protections don't exist to protect us in times of happy, when
right,
nothing's
exactly.
going on.
Exactly.
These laws, the international law against torture during wartime, exists for wartime.
Yeah.
You know, the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, and the Eighth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure and things like that, those exist for when there is trouble. It's
well, in
like
fact,
the
Third
Amendment,
which nobody remembers, you know, that you can't quarter soldiers in people's homes, came
right.
out of a time of war.
Well, exactly, exactly. And the other thing with these memos is they've started to try and spin it today, saying, you know what, this memo was only in existence from April 2003 till December when someone new came in and overturned the memo. You know, it was only in existence for about 9 months, Don't worry about it. But think of what those 9 months were, Tom. Those were the 9 months during which the atrocities at Abu Ghraib happened. That was, they believe, October and November of 2003.
Yeah, this was top-down stuff.
It was when everything started to go very south down in Guantanamo Bay and where all of those reports of atrocities happened. And so it wasn't an accident that those things happened. Oops, at the same time, there was a memo saying you can do whatever you want, and in fact, right. You should.
Before we run out of time here, you have a mustache of justice alert here.
I do. Henry Waxman is on the trail again. This time he's going after the EPA. Yay! Because the EPA just passed some new rules about lead paint. Right. But these new rules, as Henry Waxman says, cut too many corners. There are all these loopholes that let all of these lead paint corporations off the hook and let the EPA off the hook. And so going out.
And presumably will let Chinese manufacturers of stuff painted with lead paint off the hook. I mean,
exactly.
I'm guessing that that's really where it's going.
But don't worry about it. Henry Waxman's on the trail.
Good. Well, actually, that does reassure me. Christy Harvey, AmericanProgress.org. Thank you, Christy.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worst. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed and who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
There you go. When you've lost Merle Haggard, you've lost America, George. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, our favorite news service with our daily report of what's going on in Washington and the world. Hey, Ellen.
The not good news, Tom, is the Department of Labor has talked about first job claims. They rose 38,000 to 407,000 people last week. It's the highest since September 2005 in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. And Senator Obama, we expect a Clinton statement soon, but from Senator Obama, and he said that they need to expand unemployment insurance, and they need to do something in terms of investments that are going to help local governments, new jobs, basically between the lines, infrastructure issues.
Yeah. In other words, something as bad as Hurricane Katrina has hit our economy, and that's called Reaganomics, Bushonomics.
Exactly. You got it. Could have said it in a better way.
Yeah. Okay. What else is going on?
The airline industry, not exactly top of the hit parade today. There was a former FAA inspector. Actually, I think the person's still an FAA inspector who was assigned to oversee the Southwest Airlines operations, a guy by the name of Boutros. And he had raised concerns, he said, with supervisors about Southwest having missed inspections that should have grounded planes since 2003. He said his supervisor essentially, who has now been reassigned, suppressed the information, and he said he followed the chain of command without any results. And he said that the FAA tried to protect Southwest. It was not a pretty hearing today, to say the least.
Yeah. And, I noticed yesterday United had to cancel.
777s, yeah.
Yeah, all their 777 flights or put people on different aircraft. This wasn't just Southwest. There were a number of airlines that were slip-sliding along, shall we say.
Absolutely. However, the guy who was testifying about Southwest today.
Right.
Also, today there were several people testifying before the Senate, and this has to do with the banking issue, of course. Chris Cox was involved in this. Bernanke was involved in this. Treasury Undersecretary Robert Steele. and the Federal Reserve guy of New York were all involved, and Chris Dodd basically opened the question that everybody asked, and he said the stunning fall of Bear Stearns was matched only by the sweeping response to its collapse put together by the New York Fed and the Federal Reserve Board of New York Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and he said they exercised powers in some instances that had not been used since the Great Depression. He said, however, people on Main Street are struggling to pay their mortgages, and so was the rescue of Bear Stearns justified to prevent a systematic collapse of financial markets, or was it a $30 taxpayer bailout for a firm on Wall Street? And nobody had the answer to that.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious. They bailed out Wall Street, and they're not bailing out Main Street. I mean, this is the same thing that happened with the SNL crash. You know, they bailed out Neil Bush, no Silverado savings and loan. They didn't bail out the people who lost all their money.
Absolutely. And what Chris Dodd wants to do and Barney Frank wants to do is they want to take that money take some money, $400 billion, and they want to say, we want to prevent the 3.3 million people who are going to be foreclosed in their homes in the next year and a half or so. And the Republicans are not going for it.
Yeah. It's disastrous. You know, 18 billion dollars is just the subsidies that we're giving to the oil industry. That's $1 million 18,000 times, $18,000 a million times. If we simply took away the oil industry subsidies, we could give a million people $18,000, which would probably keep in their house for a couple of years. I mean, there's so much.
That would pay a lot of mortgages.
That's right. Our priorities are so screwed up. The way that the cons have been running this country since Reagan blows my mind. It just blows my mind. Every single day there's something new that just blows my mind. Anyhow, what else is going on, Ellen?
There's just a couple other things. Today, Attorney General Mukasey spoke before the budget hearing. Now, this isn't a full oversight hearing. It's only a budget hearing. He is asking for a lot of new agents and intelligence analysts. And he was asked about this and what they're going to be used for, and he said, well, it's going to be used for border security and for drug smuggling. Then he was challenged about when drug smugglers are arrested, they're apparently released for having less than 500 pounds of drugs. Now, we've got people sitting in jail for, a few tabs of acid and LSD, sorry.
Right.
What is this about? He basically did not have an answer for that.
Yeah. Well, this whole war on drugs is really a war on poor people. I mean, that's largely a war on African Americans. I mean, let's call it what it is. It's a profit center for people who want to build private prisons and sell test kits.
The private prison issue and the prison labor issue. I mean, the unions are correct to go on that. That is a huge issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is just so, so wrong. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's, let's see, coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, Brunch with Bernie. No, we don't do suck-up interviews with big-name politicians. Instead, we get politicians on the show, and they take your calls. Senator Bernie Sanders for the first hour taking your calls. Plus, Lamar Waldron, my co-author of our book on JFK, is going to deliver a bombshell on the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 40 years ago tomorrow. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.